Next case up this morning is docket number 52758, Hardy Companies, Inc. versus SN Mark, LLC.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. Dan Pulsenberg and Dan Wade for the appellant W.E. O'Neill, no relation. The court has suggested five questions. Mr. Reynolds will address four and five. Let me start with number one. The question is whether the 2003 and 2005 amendments to NRS Chapter 108 legislatively overruled the Fondren case from 1990 and changed the substantial compliance standard that this court has used for 137 years. I really don't think that there's any doubt that the legislative amendments do not do this. They don't even come near doing this. If you look at the legislative amendments as a whole, if you look at their history, they were designed to address an entirely different issue. Now, I had the pleasure of arguing the Herrick case in front of this court, the first of the Venetian lien cases. So I'm familiar with what was going on in that time period where landowners building massive projects were trying to find a way to write contracts to have contractors and subcontractors waive any lien rights to result in property that was lien-free. And that's what prompted the legislative changes in 2003. It had nothing to do with substantial compliance. In fact, if you look at the legislative history, repeatedly in 2003 and 2005, people argued that the purpose of Chapter 108 was to protect contractors and subcontractors and not to limit their rights. It was to ensure payment, not to limit payment. And in 2005, the issue in front of the legislature was the fact that we were having trouble in the surety market. And there had to be a way to come up with a way that a landowner, instead of bonding at 1.5 times the contract price, could deposit money into a construction control and a reimbursement account. These didn't have anything to do with what we're talking about here, whether it is strict compliance that there must be pre-lien notice. The legislature never even addressed that. In fact, what they did address, the one sentence that the respondent relies on in all of the statute is in NRS 108-2453, where it says, except as provided otherwise, a person may not waive or modify a right, obligation, or liability set forth in the provisions of 108. And so what they're claiming is, I suppose, that by saying you cannot in a contract waive a right, obligation, or liability, that means that you cannot waive the landowner's right to pre-lien notice. Well, that just doesn't work. First of all, right is used throughout Chapter 108, and it is almost always talking about a lien right. Right is used repeatedly throughout the amendment in 2003. Where it's sometimes talking about a lien right, and sometimes it's talking about a payment right. It's not talking about some procedural technicality. It's talking about the substantive right of contractors to be paid, not of owners to evade payment. Obligation is very infrequently used in Chapter 108, but when it's used, it's either for a landowner's obligations. In the 2005 version of 108, a landowner's obligations to try to post money or a bond, or the landowner's obligations to pay. And liability clearly means liability to pay. So this sentence doesn't mean what they're claiming it means. The rest of the section that we're talking about, 2453, when it talks about right, it is talking about lien rights. The legislature never even addressed the idea of changing Fondren. Fondren is a good case. Pre-lien notice is not essential and certainly not essential for a prime contractor. Let me go to the second question, and let me address two and three together. The second question has to do with prime contractor and the third with a disinterested owner. A prime contractor is not obligated to give pre-lien notice under 245. And the reason for that, 245 subsection 5, a prime contractor or other person who contracts directly with an owner or sells materials directly to an owner is not required to give notice pursuant to section 245. And it makes a lot of sense if you understand what pre-lien notice is. Pre-lien notice is not notice saying, hey, I'm a subcontractor saying, hey, I'm not getting paid, so I'm going to lien your property. It doesn't require non-payment. It doesn't even require the work to have been done. It's just notice saying, I'm on the job, and I may be doing work, and if I don't get paid, I will be liening. It's really a way for a subcontractor to disclose its identity to the landowner. And a prime contractor doesn't need to do that because the owner knows who the contractor is. Now, they're making an argument that the prime contractor has to contract directly with the record owner of the premises. But that's not what it says. I mean, if they're trying to do a technical reading, directly doesn't apply to prime contractor. It says a prime contractor or other person who contracts directly with an owner, or thirdly, sells materials directly to an owner, because there are circumstances where you just have a prime contractor. You contract with the prime contractor, and that person takes care of everything. But there are other circumstances where you contract with the prime contractor and with some of the material providers or laborers. Those people, now laborers are treated differently, but whenever you deal directly with somebody, that person doesn't need to put you on notice as to who they are. And we see this with change orders too. I've been in many cases where, as happened in this case, the primary, the landowner starts dealing with subcontractors. And now if they're going to claim, realize too, it says an owner. And a tenant in a leasehold is an owner under the definitions in Chapter 108. So all we have to prove is that we've contracted with an owner. It really makes sense if you look at the idea of a disinterested owner. This case is the classic mechanics lien case having to do with a lease, where the lessor and the lessee at the time of the lease contemplate the improvements to the real property. They set them out in the lease. Now, in the legislative history in 2005, especially in the Assembly Judiciary Committee, in the testimony of Richard Peel, he talks about this classic situation where the landowner leasing to a tenant who is going to make arrangements for the improvements to real property. At that point, the landowner has the opportunity, the lessor has the opportunity to provide for circumstances where there won't be any liens. And we see that in the statutes. What they can do is, to be a disinterested landowner, you can simply post a bond or make sure there's a reimbursement account for 1.5 times the contract rate. Anyone who has a lien can go against that money instead of against the property. But the whole provision, the primary idea, is that any property can have a lien against it for any improvement to that property. And to get around that exception, you have to do certain things to be a disinterested landowner. You have to, and it's not just the notice of non-responsibility. You have to actually have provided for payment under the circumstances where the lease contemplates the improvements. Now, there may be other hypotheticals that we'll face in other cases where the balance of the equities is a little bit differently, but the balance of the equities here is just the way the legislature anticipated. If you've got a lessee who goes bankrupt and has made improvements contemplated in the lease, who's going to bear the responsibility for that? The lessee is gone. It's either going to be the landowner or the people who have done the work. Either the landowner has to pay for it or those people go unpaid. And the statutes provide for how that's supposed to be done. To be a disinterested landowner, you provide for ways for the payment to be made. And if you don't provide for that, the lien can be made against
it. Mr. Polzenberg, is whether Senmark, or however it's pronounced, had notice of the agreements with Wix and what was happening. Is that a genuine issue of material fact that should have precluded summary judgment being granted by Judge Gonzalez?
Absolutely. At the very least, it's a genuine issue of material fact. I think we have shown just in the proof that we made without any discovery, they clearly were. The same manager was involved. He was on the site. He was directing our work. The lease contemplated that W.E. O'Neill would be involved as the general contractor. It provided for the improvements, and the improvements remain with the real property, and they enjoy that. So, yes, clearly, it shouldn't have been a summary proceeding. But I think once the facts are developed, we'll reach the same conclusion. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the Court, Chief Judge Perigary. My name is Ronald Reynolds. I'm here on behalf of Hardee's Companies. I'm here to address the issue that Hardee's Companies gave not only an actual lien, but a written statutory pre-lien notice. It's a statutory pre-lien notice because they followed the statute throughout. The statute has five different provisions that address this issue, any one of which would support our client's position. The first one is the definition of owner. In that definition of owner, you give it to the owner or you give it to a reputed owner. We obviously gave it to a reputed owner because we gave it to an owner in interest, and by the way, that's another definition of owner in and of itself, someone who has an interest less than fee simple. We gave it to an owner. We gave it to someone who was on the contract. We gave it to who the general contractor told us was the owner. We gave it to the entity that was the insured for the entire project. We gave it to the entity, or Hardee gave it to the entity, by all appearances, that was in charge, that was building. We're talking about one building on the property with the name of that entity that was served. So they gave notice to the reputed owner, and that is an owner. They gave notice to an owner in interest, which the respondent has admitted in their brief. They're an owner in interest. And in fact, that owner in interest in the lease agreement had authority to construct and was given the authority for this. Also, we have the notice statutes that says, if known. It says, give the owner's name, if known. The form that follows that, the statutory form, says, provide the owner's name, if known. Makes it very clear, even at the later stage of recording the notice, the owner's name, if known, and it would not defeat it. I think the legislature, concerned about this in 2003, put a couple more nails in this and probably put even a few more bolts. They passed NRS 108229.3 that says, quote, an error or mistake in the name of the owner contained in any notice does not defeat this lien. That makes it very, very clear. It does not defeat the lien. However, the court in summary judgment at the beginning of this case just decided, well, the weather has changed in Nevada and it's swung somehow towards the owner. And so we will ignore all these provisions that have never been changed. They're still there. Five different provisions, three different statutes that say very clearly that who we served is proper. It doesn't render this service defective because we served one of the owners or because we served a reputed owner. The liens are creatures of habit, or I shouldn't say creatures of habit, sorry. The liens are creatures of the statute.
Is there a requirement to serve all owners?
There is not a requirement, Your Honor. The requirement is to serve a reputed owner, and I think the court actually addressed this issue in the N. Ray Stanfield case, because I think they served one of one of the individuals who was sitting on a board, as I recall, that also had an affiliation with the other entities. And I think that goes to the issue of actual notice that I'm not really arguing, but in any event, they did not have to. I mean,
because Hardy's in a slightly different position than O'Neill. O'Neill was dealing directly with Hardy's, our sub.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's their argument. Our argument is a statutory argument, although I think there's inures to our benefit because we were dealing with an owner also. We were dealing with Wicks. We were on the premises. They had actual notice. There was actual notice by O'Neill. They admitted in their brief they had actual notice but did not
but
get off.
Contracted basic. I mean, you're telling me now you did this, but your relationship with Wicks was with O'Neill. Primarily, you had contracted with O'Neill to provide service.
No, I don't want to mislead the court on that. We gave statutory notice to who we believed was the owner, and they were an owner by statute by two different definitions. And if they made a mistake in that, then the statute clearly says.
As to that ground, but then yes. We come back to the issue of whether or not you have to give notice to all owners.
Yes, and I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. It's just give the notice to who you think the owner is. That's the only owner that we were aware of. My time is gone.
Go ahead and finish your statement.
In the respondent's brief, they make it clear that there was a transfer of ownership right at this time. ECT, their affiliate, transferred to them. They acknowledge in there that the lease put Wicks in charge of the building, and they were an owner. That's the only owner we were aware of by any of the documents that we saw from the insurance to the contracts.
Okay, colleagues, any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Dashley appearing on behalf of Respondent S.N. Mark. Start by addressing question number one that this court asked us to focus on, which is whether or not the amendments in 2003 and 2005 overrule Fondren. I would answer that question in the affirmative based on the addition. It's an entirely new statute, by the way, and it first appeared in 2003 of 108.2453. Sub 1 of that section states, as Mr. Paulsenberg cited too, that a person, which should necessarily include lien claimants, not just contractors, or landowners, rather, but a person may not waive or modify an obligation or a right or a liability, but I'm focusing really on an obligation set forth in the mechanics lien statutes. One obligation is the one that we're focusing on today, which is really what NRS 108.245, the pre-lien statute, or it's really the notice of right to lien statute, requires of contractors in order to receive the benefits of the statutory remedy of mechanics lien foreclosure actions. As this court has historically said, well, first of all, substantial compliance is not something that is a hard and fast rule in Nevada and has not been the rule in Nevada for the some 130 years, as Mr. Paulsenberg represents, or Wicks. W. O'Neill, I apologize, represents. I would say that by looking at cases like Fisher Brothers from Nevada, this court has stated that because the mechanics lien statutes are a creature of statute, they're not contained in Nevada's constitution, that compliance with the statutory requisites required to achieve this new remedy should be strictly followed. And I think only then, once those requirements have been followed, can the court, or should the court rather, liberally construe the remedies available to those lien claimants in order to provide them with the remedy that of a mechanics lien. It also should not be forgotten that these lien claimants have all contracted for the improvements with someone. They have a legal right to receive payment from the party they contracted with. And and as such, I would say that with the addition of 108.2453 sub 1, no longer should the courts excuse a failure on a lien claimant's part to fulfill its obligation to serve a pre-lien notice. I think that this statutory interpretation is in line with numerous authorities that we cited to, which I think demonstrate that as a general proposition, that this is the way that it should be. And that's corpus juris segundum of the regarding mechanics liens, as well as...
Counsel, what of the legislative history surrounding this Mr. Pulsenberg talked about from 2003 and 2005, as it relates to the trilogy of cases, Las Vegas Plywood, the Durable Developers, and the other case that we've been talking about this morning, the Fountain case?
Well, I wish I had something definitive to cite to you. I think that most of the testimony is from contractors, and they're interested in an outcome, frankly, that results in them being paid. And I think that that's exactly what these statutes are enacted to do. However, there has to be a balance. The law has to be balanced against the property rights of landowners and their due process rights, frankly. And I think that landowners are entitled to not only an opportunity to be heard on the matter, especially after the fact, after the taking, if you will, has occurred by the imposition of a lien, but they're entitled to notice.
You're talking about due process and taking from the other side of the hallway, so to speak, and just being the devil's advocate. The folks who have supplied material and labor would venture that they've had a taking also. So if I toss those two things up in the air and say they're even, how do we play this out?
Absolutely, and I understand that. Where I would point you to, I guess, is the fact that these contractors and subcontractors have already all of the rights that any contracting party does in the state of Nevada. They can sue on their contract with the party they contracted with. And the reality is that this remedy is a statutorily created additional remedy to those other legal rights that those people enjoy that my client, frankly, does not. And so I would say that if there's going to be a balancing, there still needs to be a balancing of the interests of the due process rights of the landowner.
Counsel, I'd like to follow up on a question posed by Justice Gibbons during appellant's argument. Are you suggesting that where the owner has actual knowledge of the contractor, that the pre-lien notice is still a prerequisite to the lien?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that it is a prerequisite to the lien, and the reason for that is because, again, the statute, it should NRS 108.2245 require a notice to be given, then it should be given, and it should not be excused based on actual knowledge.
So your view of the case is that this court should issue an opinion that says henceforth to perfect a lien in Nevada, even if the owner has actual knowledge, you must comply specifically with the pre-lien notice requirement of service in order to secure a lien in this state.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would be the appropriate opinion of the court. First of all, it's just too easy, frankly, in today's day and age to determine the ownership of a piece of property.
I guess what's troubling me, at least with respect to Hardy, is when the lease, at least it's represented, I didn't have a chance to read the lease, but the lease specifically says, quote, landlord approves tenant's use of O'Neill Industries, Inc. That's in the lease. That would certainly suggest to the average reader that your client, as the successor to ECT, knows who O'Neill is if they read the lease.
Well, O'Neill Industries is not the same as W.E. O'Neill Construction Company of California, for one. For another, that lease provision doesn't require that the lessee use that contractor, merely that they're pre-approved, so that if they decide to go that way, They had used them in the past, it's my understanding. I don't know that that's contained in the record. But they wanted essentially pre-approval of that. We didn't know who they were going to use, and therefore it was required under the lease that any contract to be entered into be given to the landowner under that same section and be approved, which did not happen.
Did the lessor have the right to approve not only the contractor, but its subcontractors as well?
I do not believe that the lease provided for the approval of subcontractors.
Okay. Mr. Dashley, let's say, and the seven of us are going to meet and decide what to do, and let's say we disagree with you on the legislative modification issue, and we do believe it's substantial compliance still under Nevada law. Is there an issue of fact as to whether your client had notice of these two contractors, Hardy and O'Neill Construction Company, and the work they were performing?
Well, below, in front of the district court, it really was a legal issue that was being decided, which was whether or not this statute.
So the judgment was based upon the legal issue.
Correct.
The Judge Gonzalez felt that the legislation modified the pre-existing cases, and therefore summary judgment was appropriate, and didn't get to the issue of whether your clients had notice of these contracts.
It certainly was not fully litigated on our side of the equation, because frankly it wasn't the focus of our motion, and certainly I think that our client, if the court is going to go the way of substantial compliance, I think that my client should have an opportunity to present the prejudice that it was faced with. Again, actual knowledge is misleading, because actual knowledge of what? How much in improvements were going to be made? When was the actual knowledge as to the commencement of construction attained? Could my client have taken actions that would have protected itself? That's really that's why the due process issue is so important on the notice. Because, and frankly, Fondren even states that the purpose of the pre-lien statute is to put the owner on notice of work and materials furnished by third persons with whom he has no direct contract. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I would turn to 108.245 sub 5 and say, even if W.A. O'Neill is a prime contractor, are deemed to be a prime contractor, that statute should not obviate their need to give other owners of other interests in the property with notice and an opportunity to protect themselves. Wix had every opportunity to protect itself. It contracted with W.E. O'Neill for the improvements, and it received the notices of right to lien from Hardy. My client, however, did not receive such notice and therefore was not able to protect itself in the face of what could potentially become mechanics liens against its property in the excess of.
And I understand that. Well, so what your position is that a notice to a tenant is not a notice to somebody that is an owner. You would disagree with what their argument is, and therefore saying that was insufficient then.
Well, I just don't see how a construction of the legislature's wording there in the face of the fact that the purpose of that is supposed to. You don't have that requirement to give that notice when you're the one contracting with the owner, because that owner knows. They just entered into the contract with you. It makes no sense to be required to require that notice be given to them.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt your thought.
Can I just finish it really briefly?
Yeah, sure.
What I'm concerned in and what I want you all to understand is what I'm focused on also is the fractionalized interests that properties in Nevada hold. We can have numerous situations that I can foresee creating massive problems here on due process that I think my client should be protected with. Life estates, any type of contingent remainder, fee simples when you're contracting with the lessee. All of these people outside do not get notice or an opportunity to protect themselves if the notice is given to the lessee only. And I would suggest then that the only reading of 108.245 sub 5 is to absolve a prime contractor of giving notice to the owner that they contract with. If you want to affect your lien as to any other fractionalized property interests in that property, you must give your notice to those property owners as well, so that they have the quintessential, the very beginning notice and an opportunity to protect themselves throughout the proceedings.
What does owner or reputed owner mean? I'm sorry, Justice Hurst. Yeah, just a follow-up. What does reputed owner mean to you then, like that statutory language?
Well, I think it's somebody that holds themselves out to be the owner. And that's definitely included in the definition of an owner. And I would suggest that a homeless person standing on the corner of the property could represent themselves as an owner of the property and contract for improvements and bind, by this very definition, all actual owners of the property that don't receive notice of the improvements. That's a real problem. And I think it boils down to due process and lack of notice. That's why our statutes require this notice and the opportunity to be heard in a speedy manner under 108.2275. Those two things working together are what provide due process in the face of this very grievous taking without an opportunity to be heard first.
Counsel, Justice Hardesty, I know you have something, but as we've been discussing this, going back and looking at the facts in terms of SNMARC being involved in on-site approval through its person responsibility as to certain changes and eventually authorizing payment by your client. So weren't they noticed?
That's not the written notice that's required under NRS 108.245, and I would argue that the quality of the notice is really the issue then. When was it received? What notice was received? Certainly at some point, my client becomes aware that improvements are being made on the property. The problem is, do they have the ability to go out and force WIX to post a bond? Do they have the ability at this point to record the notice of non-responsibility and serve it on the proper people when you don't have an address? They don't. They're really. It's like a de facto discrimination, if you will. I hope I'm using the term right.
Counsel, they must have thought SNMARC or their representative had some type of authority when they acquiesced to their request to do certain things in certain ways.
Well, I would.
I'm troubled by the argument you're presently making that they just flat didn't know. I understand the distinction between the statutory requirement and substantial compliance, that I do understand. But in general, as you're making that argument, it bothers me that you're the total gloss over, so to speak, that you're giving it.
Well, I would liken it to a situation where we require service of a summons and complaint, despite the fact that one knows of the fact that the complaint has been filed against you. In situations of due process, you're entitled to the written notice. And I think that that's what was lacking here, and that's what was required. That's what the district court found in the face of the amendment to the statutes. And I certainly didn't, I don't think, hit all of the points that you guys had raised, unfortunately, in my time.
I think Justice Hardesty still has a question.
I do. I appreciate your argument about the strict application of the statute and the pre-lien notice. My question is, how do you address Mr. Reynolds' argument on behalf of Hardy that 108.2293 and 2294 seem to afford, as late as going into trial, the opportunity to rectify errors made in these notice statutes?
Well, fortunately, I think that's an easy one for me to respond to, and that's because NRS 108.229 sub 3 and 4 don't apply to the notice of right to lien. They apply on their face. They say an error, mistake in the name, and frankly, Mr. Reynolds was reading it out, but he left out the most important wording of the statute. It says an error, mistake in the name of the owner contained in any notice of lien does not defeat the lien. It doesn't talk about notice of right to lien under NRS 108.245. And I think, again, based on my arguments, that's the notice that's required to afford due process to my client. If you've already received that notice, an error in the name should be corrected later. Clearly, if there's a problem with the name of the owner, if that owner's already received a notice of right to lien from the contractor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, counsel, the briefs were excellent. Your arguments were helpful. We appreciate it. And this matter will stand submitted. We will stand in recess. until 11:30.